Welcome to the Scaling Tech Podcast, the podcast for growing engineering teams. As always, this episode is brought to you by AgilityFeet.com, providers of technical staffing and software development services in Latin America for clients globally. I'm Aaron Syme, host of the Scaling Tech Podcast, and for today's live episode, I'm joined by David Bland, co-author of Testing Business Ideas and founder of Precoil. David describes his work as an independent arbiter of reality because he works with leadership teams to surface hidden risks in growth strategies and issue evidence-based verdicts in weeks. His work has protected companies from wasting millions on bets that won't scale and created millions in value by providing by determining which ideas will drive growth. So his book, Testing Business Ideas, is an industry classic for entrepreneurs of all types in startups and large corporations. It's sold over 100,000 copies in over 20 different languages. David, I'm delighted to have you join us today. Thank you for being here, my friend.
Thank you for having me. It's good to see you again.
It is good to see you. And we're also joined by my colleague, Mariana Lopez, who will co-host with me today. Mariana is our COO at Agility Feet, and she's also an expert in user research and UX design, having studied human-computer interaction at Carnegie Mellon. And she's worked with many of our clients on choosing where to go next in their application development. I asked her to join me today because I know she's also a big fan of David's work. And so, Mariana, I know you have a lot of questions as well.
Yeah, exactly. Thanks for having me. I'm really excited. I've used the Testing Business Ideas book quite significantly. So,
excellent.
Thank you.
Excellent. No, really been looking forward to this conversation. And our spin on it today, the way we're going to talk about it is evidence-driven engineering. And so although Mariana and I have lots of questions for David, I'd also like to invite all of our viewers to join the conversation. And if you're watching us live on YouTube or LinkedIn, just ask a question in the comments anytime and we'll address it. But I want to start with David. I know that you've worked with a lot of business leaders on strategy. How often do you see engineering leadership participating in those conversations as well? And how is their approach different, if it is?
Yeah, not enough. I need to see more of it. And I was having a chat about this yesterday with a bunch of leaders where I'm noticing we're taking our strategy and we're sort of like waterfalling it down into the teams. And I am a big believer of agile and iterative software development and lean. And I think I first got introduced to that stuff in around 2000. And I fully believe that that is the way we deliver working, you know, product that provides value and solutions that provide value. However, what I think it's morphed into now is it's almost like the decisions are made by someone else of what to build. And we end up saying, oh, we're going to iterate through this thing, but we're doing it in a really confined space. You know, we don't have a lot of space to actually test what can work and what can't work. And so I'd like to see more participation from engineering leadership early on. And the way I view that is almost like through three circles. So I call it desirability, viability, feasibility. And so feasibility is a lot of the, can we build this? What are the risks about delivering this? And that's usually where engineering shines. It's not exclusively where they shine, but it's usually where you can provide all your expertise about the risk. And I honestly believe that people need to know about that risk sooner versus later, instead of trying to figure out, oh, wait, we actually can't build this the way we thought we could. And it's almost too late because we've made promises. Of course, you would never see that happen, but I've seen that happen.
No, never. I like how you framed it there too, in terms of saying that it's iterating within a constrained space. And so I guess for engineering leaders in particular, that space that they're, the way I hear that anyways, is that the engineering leader is kind of the one constrained within that space. They can iterate within here perhaps, but only within these bounds maybe that are set by the, you know, set for them. So, you know, maybe let's kind of start next with telling us a little bit more like what you would describe as evidence-driven engineering looking like.
Well, it's very much connected back to hypotheses and assumptions. So when you think about, you know, are we going to build something? They're kind of three big questions I ask. One is, do they want this or do they need this? Which is a lot of desirability risk. It's a lot around the customer, unmet needs, all that. Usually it's user research, designers, marketing, sales. You know, there's a bunch of people that can talk about that type of risk because they're very connected to the customer. The next theme is viability, which is a lot of should we do this? And that's around cost and revenue. Usually product, although product can play in multiple zones, but product is there, accounting might be there, finance, people are like, does this make sense for the organization to even work on? And we're going to move the needle in some way. And then feasibility is a lot of the can we? It's can we do this? And yes, that's where engineering plays a big role. Also, you might be collaborating with, you know, safety, compliance, legal, regulatory risk, anything that's going to prevent you from actually executing on it. And so when I think about engineering leadership, you need to bridge that gap between the other two. And quite often what I'm noticing in companies is that engineering isn't the biggest risk anymore. You all can build almost anything. A lot of the things failing that I see inside companies are failing because the customer didn't want it, or if they wanted it, they wouldn't pay enough for it. And I do think engineering needs to be part of this conversation sooner versus later, versus treating it as like those three circles should be overlapping, not silos inside your org.
Yeah, absolutely. So I have a story maybe I'll share, kind of a little bit of maybe what not to do. And this would be more from a startup perspective, that one of our colleagues in our team, who's a developer, shared with me. And he told me how he partnered with some years ago with a good friend on a business idea for a marketplace for in the home construction industry. They wanted to build like a B2B marketplace, I believe. And our colleague, our developer, made a clickable prototype using an online tool and was encouraging his friend, who was the industry expert, to get it in front of users. But his friend, the founder, you know, resisted. And, you know, long story short, they only actually ended up showing the app to potential investors, not even customers, but potential investors after over a year of development work. And, you know, they had no customers on hand to show, just a couple of like verbal commitments of people who said, yeah, I'd probably use this. So as you can imagine, those funding conversations didn't go well. But they had a couple of conversations with investors like that. And then, you know, the project, the startup died, basically. So, you know, give me a little bit of kind of your reaction to there, and how often do you still see that, whether it's a startup or in a corporate, you know, that sort of anti-pattern?
Yeah, I would say right now it's probably 80% corporates and 20% startups. And I still work with startups in Silicon Valley and kind of remotely around the world. And it's far too common still with regards to not testing soon enough with your customer base. And then when you think about raising money, I like to raise money from my customers, not from the investors early on. When you raise money from investors early on, you're giving away, you know, a lot of your company. And usually I think of capital and raising funds for when I need to scale. You know, I have something that's already has traction and I need to scale that and I need more money to scale that, but it's already almost proven out. So I think, you know, this idea of I'm going to build the perfect thing and then pitch it to investors, usually investors are going to ask, where's your traction? That's the T word they use quite a bit.
Yes.
Where's your traction? And if you don't have any, there are a lot of investors that aren't going to be investing in you unless they know you personally and have invested in you before. So I do think even though it's uncomfortable, it's getting that thing out in front of customers to get real feedback from them, because that's going to shape what you build over time. It's not going to be this perfect thing that's going to work right away. It's going to be shaped by customer input. And, you know, without that, it's really, really tough to get it right.
Yeah, definitely. On the flip side, so I want to tell a story where we were working with a client and we were, they wanted to push their customers to fill out some additional forms, and the customers weren't filling them out. So their brilliant idea was to build a modal, you know, that would remind users to build this out. And I was pushing really hard against that, because it disrupted the experience and wouldn't really add any value. What we what we agreed on was we used one of the test cards and we said, this is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to test it. And if at least 10% of the users click on this modal, we'll keep it. And I was like, okay, I'm willing to make this compromise. And we ran the modal for 2 weeks and less than 0.5% of their users clicked on it. And we were very happy. It green-lighted us to go do user research and understand why people weren't filling out those forms and how we could incentivize them to fill them out. So that's an amazing success story. But in this case, I was pushing back and they wanted to expose their users to it. Sometimes when we're running some of these with clients that do have a user base, they're more reluctant to expose their users to something that's unfinished or unpolished or a bad experience. How do you handle that when there's brand perception in the way of testing your business idea?
Yeah, there are a few ways I approach it. It's pretty common. So we don't want to confuse our users, or we don't want to look like we don't know what we're doing. And brand is important, especially if your brand has been around for over 100 years, which is some of the companies I work with. Yeah. A couple of ways we do it is, one, I view it as like testing with your customers instead of testing on your customers. So this idea of, can we invite people in and test with them and be very open that this isn't fully developed yet and we need your feedback. And I do think that's still important to test with. And I feel B2C kind of gets this. I feel like B2B is lagging a little bit. And with B2B, we have this culture of, unless you have something polished and you're pitching, don't talk to the customer. You know. And I do see that culture changing a bit, where it's more of, let's talk with them. Let's try to find out what other problems they have. Let's not pitch them right away. Let's actively listen. Let's do all that. So that is happening, but it's a cultural change inside companies because we're used to just pitching them, selling them things, and not talking to them otherwise, mostly just leaving them alone. So I do see that changing. And I love that you had the success criteria in that card, because that card, the way it goes is, you have your hypothesis, you have your test, you have your metrics, so what you're going to measure in your test, and then you have your success criteria. That is the hardest box to fill out, because people don't know what to put in there. It's like, I don't know what a good test looks like, or I don't know what success looks like. And usually what I'm recommending there is, talk to your leadership a bit, you know, find out what kind of evidence they need to see to bring that idea forward. And they should have a clear idea. If they don't, this is how we end up with zombies inside the company, where they're not alive, not dead, and they live on forever because there's no success criteria. It's a different topic. Happy to explore that too with you all too. But that acceptance criteria needs to be defined. Otherwise, you run the test and you kind of shrug your shoulders and say, "Well, I think that worked." And then you move forward. And you really need to come back and say, okay, did that actually support or refute the hypothesis or the evidence? Does it support or refute it? And that discipline needs to be in place. If you don't write it down, you're not going to remember, or your brain's going to play tricks on you. We call it after the fact rationalization. So what's going to happen is, you're going to say, you know what? We needed 0.5% people to click on that. And you're like, no, we said 10%. And like, no, 0.5, that's fine. That's enough for us. So you do have to write it down, or your brain will just, it's a bias there. You'll just basically buy into it no matter what happens.
Definitely.
Go ahead, Mariana. It
makes everybody accountable on the team. And then you can go back and you can't rationalize your way out of a bad experiment, which is really what you want, right? When you run these experiments to sift through the good ideas and the bad ideas. I'd love to hear more about zombie projects. Could you walk us through what a zombie project is?
And how? Yeah, I think we've all been around them or been on them, unfortunately. And it's usually, they keep pivoting no matter what, you know, they just meander through the company. It's something we work on, but it's not driving meaningful revenue. But no one kills it because no one wants to kill it. So there's probably an element of sunk cost fallacy there too, where we've invested in it and we don't want to see it fail. And it's usually from leadership. You know, I've had teams say, this doesn't make any sense anymore. We shouldn't work on that. And leadership would respond with, yeah, but what if we give it a little more time or a little more money or put a few more people on it? Maybe it'll work then. And so there's this reluctance to let things go. And so having a process or having a system where you say, look, we're going to review this thing at this date. Here are the metrics we're going to look at. If the metrics aren't where we need them to be, we're either going to pivot that thing in a different direction, or we're going to kill it or park it or punt or compost or whatever the word is, shelve you use, but you're not actively working on it. And what I've noticed is companies don't have that process in place. we have a lot of process of starting things, but we don't have a good process for killing things that we shouldn't be working on. So unfortunately, I was writing about this yesterday. I don't think companies die because of one big bet. They die because of all these like undead half bets they have, like permeating their company. And those just suck morale. They suck time, money, resources, energy. And you don't have a process for just stopping and working on them. So I do think, unfortunately, I have a little assessments I do and such, and I have a process where we try to go after that. One of my current clients, we've saved $12 million this year by killing off 43% of the projects they shouldn't be working on. $12 million. Just by killing off stuff we shouldn't be working on. So there is a real impact to those. And I think we need to understand the symptoms, understand when we're working on one, or we see them, and asking those questions of, why are we still working on this? Is there a way to kill this off? You know, what does success look like? And if you don't have good answers to that, you have to start to question, you know, is this going to work here? Because I just think it's really hard to be successful when you have that drain, that organizational drag on your company.
Yeah, absolutely. I am a master at rationalizing after the fact, unfortunately, as Mariana probably knows about me. But it's hard to do. So I think having those written down in advance and are super important. So along these lines of like how company culture affects the decision making in this and zombie projects, we've got a question here, sort of filling the screen from Lauren, working in situations where as a corporate innovator and product manager, she's worked in situations where a team based on empirical results determined that an idea was not going to be valuable, but higher ups in the company perceived this as a failure because expectations had already been set basically early in the year. So what strategies would you suggest for reframing a testing outcome from failure into progress so that you have the flexibility in the roadmap to allow for these types of visits? Thank you, Lauren, for that question.
Yeah, with regards to the process I use, it's called EMT, extract, map, test. So we look at what a roadmap is, and we'll say, what kind of risk do we have in this roadmap? So the questions I ask are, what would have to be true for this to work? What would have to be true for this to work? And we break those down, and we just ask those questions. Now, I imagine when you ask those questions inside your company, you're going to hear things that sound, that map back to those three themes: desirable, viable, feasible. They might not be worded exactly in those words, but they're going to be things that are the do they, can we, should we questions. These things have to be true. We have to have enough customers. They have to have the need. They have to be able to pay enough. We have to be able to build it, a low enough cost, all that. So normally what I do is I'm not trying to make people feel defensive. I'm just saying, what would have to be true for this to work? And some things you don't test. Some things are just, you just go do them. But the things with uncertainty, you should have answers to those questions. You know, like, what would have to be true? Oh, well, here are the things that would have to be true. Great. Do we have a plan for addressing those? And quite often we don't. We have sprints and we have a roadmap, and it's all acting as if things are going to work out and we're going to deliver this stuff. And we're treating it almost like requirements. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm trying to do with companies is say, look, what are the things that would have to be true for this to work? What's our plan? What's our learning plan? Sometimes we call them a learning plan. Sometimes we call them an experiment plan. But what is our plan to address those? And what we have is just a little, you know, a little spreadsheet that has desirability, viability, feasibility risks that we all said would have to be true for that to work. What are our tests that we're going to run to go find out, and who's running them and when, and what's our priority to those? Normally, what I recommend is we don't start in feasibility land of here are all the things that are have to be true for us to be able to build it, because sometimes, one, those aren't the riskiest because we can build almost anything, and two, they're not as risky as people not wanting it and not paying enough for it. You know, mm-hmm. I've worked on projects where a team has been working on for 3 years, you know, in manufacturing, and we didn't have traction externally, and we ended up killing the thing because people didn't want it, or the switching costs were really high, and they weren't going to switch to that new solution. The solution was great, but people weren't going to buy it, you know? So when you think about that, the way I try to approach that situation is not making people feel defensive. It's more about, hey, what would have to be true for that to work? Great. What's our plan to address that? And then let's actively work through that plan in addition to everything else. So some of my clients will have like stakeholder reviews and things where people have to bring that plan. and they have a conversation with leadership, and I work with leadership to ask the right questions with that plan instead of, you know, are we going to get ROI next month on this thing, which is normally the kind of questions you get. What, you know, where's our risk? How have we paid down our risk? Has risk increased or decreased, you know, since the last time we've met? So there's it's not overly complicated. It's more about what has to be true. Are we tracking what has to be true? And are we trying to find out if it's true?
I really like that framing around it, because it, as you said, you're trying to make sure that they're not feeling defensive about it. So what would have to be, you know, what would have to be true for this to work? If, how do you bring that back up, let's say, like into that person's like KPIs for the year or their quarterly goals, which may be separate from the team, you know, if they're a stakeholder, separate from the team that they're talking to, right? Like, how do you, for instance, if as a team, you say, well, this is our learning plan, I think our experiment plan, as you said, I really like that idea. But if you're calling something an experiment that somebody, you know, put in their annual review with their supervisor that we're going to get this done this year, then they don't really want you to experiment on it, right? There's some misaligned incentives there. So how would you kind of bring that back up into that sort of like KPI or expectations for people so that teams can work in this way?
Yeah, ideally that conversation happens before that commitment,
right? has been made. For sure.
So, you know, what I'm doing is I'm working with HR and I'm working with other folks to think through, okay, how do we incentivize people to embrace this way of working? And that goes everything from KPIs, but also to coaching, you know, internal capability. I train a lot of coaches inside companies, and now like the certification for this, and also for EMT and for, you know, like your yearly goals. There are coaching criteria in there now as far as being able to actively coach. Because I can train a lot of people, but if you're not actively applying it on, let's say, projects that are, you know, being commercialized or different products, you're not really applying it. You're not getting the benefit out of it. I mean, I could train people all day, but I want you to actually see the risk reduction. And like I said with the other client where we saved $12 million, that's by applying it to real opportunities. So I think it's a mix of having the conversation about incentives, how do we incentivize people? And also, you know, when we get to our plans and our yearly reviews, you know, what does that look like as well for building that internal capability? But I don't have a perfect answer for someone's already committed and then they don't want you to test. I mean, that's more of just a, you know, you have to have those conversations about, okay, what are the risks in your KPIs? What are the assumptions in your KPIs? And I've had that conversation with a few people over the years that have written books on like OKRs and things. And what we've tried to do is say, like, what are the big assumptions that would have to be true behind these? And can we at least put a spotlight on those? And I don't see that happening a lot either sometimes with OKRs. I feel like the way they're working is, I don't know, they're very popular. I don't get me wrong, but the way they're being implemented sometimes it makes me scratch my head. So overall, I would say it's going to be a hard conversation if people have already committed to things and then you're saying, let's go test. So it's more about how are we committing? How are we making those commitments? And if you hear a theme through everything in my answers, it's always about like what would have to be true? What are the assumptions? And can we go visibly prioritize those and go test them? I mean, it's the principles are the same. It's just the tactics look a little different depending on how you're applying it and what you're extracting risk from.
That makes sense. Mariana, where would you like to go next?
Definitely. Let's talk a little bit about how testing and how validating your ideas has changed with how fast you can actually do things. Feasibility has become a little bit less, timelines have reduced, everything is now almost possible, right? And I, how do you balance a little bit of testing your idea with how fast it is to generate products, right? Before we would do wireframe tests or pencil and paper tests of some of the things. And it had that like unpolished, not yet finished feel to it. And now we're getting a lot of push of let's just vibe code the application and have users walk through something real. What are the drawbacks of you know, using the fast AI method to test?
Yeah, I love vibe coding and all the stuff that we're seeing, it's very disruptive to internal processes of how we build things and commercialize things. I just spoke to a Silicon Valley, I won't name him, but is a chief innovation officer in Silicon Valley. And he told me that his product team is no longer writing product requirement documents, PRDs. They are now vibe coding everything and just handing it over. And I was thinking, okay, we don't know what the impact of doing that is yet. You know, I also talked to senior level execs who, I think it's just fun to vibe code things. And it's almost like back in the day when they were a developer, you know, and they're so hands-off for so long. It's like, oh, I can finally be hands-on kind of in a way, you know, and I could vibe code something and I could hand it off to someone to either make that design real or write that code. And in reality, I think the quality is very subjective. It does look polished, but the information hierarchy is usually all wrong. And that code is not something that we're going to be able to use. We'll probably have to rewrite everything. Mm-hmm. And the design probably needs to be reworked. So there is still a lot of rework, I think, with the vibe coding sort of trend. However, I do think for communication and communicating about MVP, it is interesting. The one challenge I think we run into, though, is when you don't show anything that's low fidelity. So I'll use this in terms of low fidelity, high fidelity. So low fidelity, yeah, like your sketches and your wireframes and all that, you don't get feedback when you show those to people. You don't get feedback on, oh, I wish that button was red or blue, or I wish you'd move that over here, because it's a sketch. It's obviously not working. You're just showing something conceptually, trying to get feedback, trying to see, is this of value in any way? You don't get a lot of usability feedback of, oh, I wish that sketch was like looking like this in the sketch. I mean, you usually talk about value, and it's because people understand, look, this thing isn't fully polished. However, you vibe code something, it looks polished. It may even kind of work because you have like super bass or something in the back end and some, like, you know, a couple things hooked up. And the kind of feedback you might get there is about usability. It's about, oh, I wish that button was green, or I wish that was blue, or I wish you'd switch this flow. And what happens sometimes is you infer or you imply that they think it's valuable because they're telling you what they want it to look like instead, because it looks really polished and they're giving you feedback on something that seems really polished. However, be mindful that they might give you that kind of feedback all day. They still will not buy it. They would still never use it. You can make all those changes. And when you go back to them and say, okay, here's the price, they're just gonna walk away. So I'm a little worried that we're skipping the step where we start to truly understand, is this valuable to the customer? And we're showing them something polished, which is fine. However, we're not setting the context properly, and they're giving us a bunch of usability feedback, and we're not understanding whether they actually pay for it or not. So that is something I am keeping my eye on. I'm not saying it's huge widespread yet, but I do have teams that have misinterpreted usability feedback for value and then been surprised later on when the customers wouldn't pay after they told them to change all the button colors and change the flow, move the features around. And it's accelerated that a bit is my concern.
Awesome. I also heard there something that sounded interesting, and I hadn't really thought about it, but with like the vibe coding, which I admit I'm a big fan, you lose that sort of like blank page. So design is reworking something to create the information architecture, but there was already a bad information architecture to work from, and engineering is working on fixing the code, but there was already bad code to start with, which I can see a pitfall there as well. Have you seen any of that?
I mean, I don't know if Aaron, have you seen that too? Because I do think there's a lot of rework happening that we're not openly talking about within this.
Yeah.
Push.
No, I definitely agree. And I think people are starting to talk about that a little bit more. And I think it's a challenge. I mean, I as someone who's also been hands off from engineering for a long time, I love the idea of being able to vibe code things, but I think there's a challenge. I don't know if it's more or less if the person, you know, like the executive in question had an engineering background in the past or not. I could argue that either way, maybe, but there's still a challenge it looks like it's 80% done. So, and if we want to do like A/B testing, maybe just push it out there, right? But that doesn't mean it's scalable. And so I think there's a lot of challenge with, there's always been some challenge with trying to push ideas out for engineering managers? Of at what point do you push it out? What level of technological maturity, you know, or immaturity can we handle in this for the sake of testing the ideas? And it feels like vibe coding has a potential of making that worse, right? Because it does give the impression, visually at least, of being more complete than it is from a, you know, DevOps perspective, let's say.
It's not necessarily a new problem. It's just, right. It's been right. accelerated, and it's been much more popularized. So back when we were building, you know, MVPs, which we call minimum viable products, which that term has been used all kinds of different ways now. However, one of the things I would always say early on is like, look, you determine what's minimum, but the customer decides if it's viable. And we would go through this process and we would learn. And I would say, look, these are built for learning. We're building this MVP to learn. And if we learn what we need, we might throw it away because it didn't work. We also might throw it away because it worked, because what we have is not going to scale and it's not wired up in a way that makes sense. And so we have to throw away what we've built that works. And people have a hard time with that sometimes, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know how many you have vibe coded products where you're like, oh, this thing doesn't quite work, but I really don't want to click the delete button yet. You know, we're going to become like digital hoarders, you know? We're just going to hoard all these vibe coded things we've built that we pay however many much, you know, much a month for the credits or whatever, because we have a hard time throwing away. I used to do these workshops where we would just sketch out ideas and I would say, don't talk. Sketch out your ideas as fast as you can, and then we're going to pick your favorite one and wad it up and throw it away. And people would not want to wad up and throw away their favorite idea. It's like, oh no, that could be a really good idea. It's like, you just came up with this 30 seconds ago, you know? Right. But like, oh, I'm already sure. Like, we fall in love with this so quickly that I'm a little concerned that we're not going to throw away the stuff even that it works. Like, I have some vibe coded stuff out there, and I have no problem throwing it away and having it rebuilt the right way if I get the right signal from the market. And I don't think a lot of us are going to take that approach. I think we're going to cling to it, or we're going to try to scale it, you know, and see how that works. But I think you have to be willing to throw it away if it works or if it doesn't work.
So let's talk from the engineering manager's perspective of what, in order to help determine that, right? So we've got the, like in the idea card that you and Mariana were talking about, we list our success criteria, which is kind of also, you know, what are the metrics that we're looking for to determine if we're going to throw away this idea or not. So to gather those metrics, we probably need some instrumentation built into the application in order to do that, right? So what kind of instrumentation do you recommend engineering teams build in? How can they help support the business and make it easier for them to test those goals? Because maybe if it's easier for them to test the goals, they'll be more likely to put in a learning plan, for example.
Yeah, well, I think having instrumentation is important. Now, you will have to check with security and such to see, you know, if I go out and buy Mixpanel, which I love Mixpanel, I've had some of my bigger corporate clients say, no, we're not going to use Mixpanel because we don't want our information going through their API. Valid, you know, I mean, I don't personally agree with that, but you know, do you have anything that's like Mixpanel internally we can use? You know, that's usually my next question. But having something where you can track the what. Now, be mindful that we're only tracking the what with quantifiable information. So what people click on, you know, what they did inside the application, that's all the what. We still need to find out the why, and that's more qualitative. Yeah. And we have to figure out, you know, that by talking to them normally or having other things where it allows us to have a conversation with them. So I would just, my advice to engineering teams would be, don't over optimize on the what, because I see as companies just go way too advanced on all the A/B testing and everything, and then completely neglect talking to customers on why they did a thing. So we're making these big bets off of what they did, but we don't know the why. It's like, oh, well, like they clicked on this part of the app and they reserved a lot more hotel rooms this time. That must be because of what we just like fill in the blanks of why they did it, but we don't know. So what I also recommend is having that connection to your customers, if possible, even weekly. I mean, that's something Teresa Torres writes about quite a bit. And I'm a big fan of her work, and just the idea of keeping connected with your customers and trying to understand the why behind what they're doing. And so that's the big advice, was I think you'll figure out the what and how to measure the what. And there's some metrics we can talk about there, but also don't forget the why. Don't forget connecting to people. And some of the big opportunities I've seen in companies was, you know, tidbits we heard in those weekly interviews with customers about, like one of the ones I have in the book is we're really struggling juggling selling and buying a home at the same time. You know, that was my big project at realtor.com when I was coaching them on, was we kept hearing in customer interviews, people were really struggling with trying to buy and sell a house. And so what we wired together was just this little Pendo flow, this little modal thing that says, hey, struggling to buy and sell at the same time. And we put it on the page where we knew those people were and start here. And they would click, they would fill out a couple fields. And then we would create a report for them. You know, the project manager, his name was Dave Masters. He would create a report for them. And then he would talk to them again. He's like, here's my link to Calendly. Talk, if you want to talk about this report, I'd love to know how valuable it was. And by learning that, they took a whole piece of their architecture and moved it over so people could interact with something. And they actually didn't have to build much. They just repurposed what they already had. But the flow was not in a way where people could uncover that, you know? And so they're really struggling. And we heard that through the customer interviews. So I would say from an engineering point of view, don't neglect the why. And also don't be afraid to be on those conversations, even if you're not leading them. Like, take notes, just listen. You're going to understand so much more context of what you're building and why you're building it by just participating in that. I honestly believe like your most valuable time isn't always writing code.
Right.
There's so much else that goes on there. And listening on these calls, just block out some time every week and listen. There's a lot you can learn about the why, and it's going to end up impacting and shaping what you're building.
Definitely. Continuous discovery is one of my favorite concepts as well. And I really like the example that you use, because you put the pain point in the context where it belongs. Sometimes when you implement these continuous discoveries, you fall into the trap of the users that are always willing to test, and they don't really have all the problems that you might be trying to find. So that was an excellent example of like finding the right user in the right moment. I don't know if you have any other tips of like when you're trying to test a business idea, how to find which customers to talk to.
Quite often, it's not an overall segment. It's not your just, I'm always nervous when we talk about like what would have to be true for this to work. Okay.
Right.
So we talk about desirability and we say, oh, customers will have to have this, whatever this need. I'm like, okay, which customer? That's usually one of my first questions. You said customers, that could be a lot of different people. Let's get specific. And ideally when we're running tests, it's for a very specific segment or subsegment. So we say, oh, do they have the problem? Are they aware of the problem they have and are actively seeking a solution to that problem? Ideally, that's where you start, because you're starting with people that, okay, you know they have this problem. They know they have this problem. They are aware that they even have the problem and they're trying to find a solution to it. And maybe that's through like using your app in weird ways. You know, I worked at like tech startups for first 10 years of my career, and they're all software as a service, mostly B2B. And we would see things like, oh, they're using the notes field, but they're putting a bunch of weird stuff in there that aren't really notes that we would intend. What's going on there? Let's go find out. You know, so you'll hear about these things that you'll observe what they're doing inside your app that just feel like abnormal, you know? And I think that's like a sign. That's a sign that there's something that could be there where you could find a way to solve for something maybe in a different way that the customer isn't even aware of. And so I'm a big believer of that. And so working through that with your team, you know, if you have that, call them trios or squads or pods or whatever you want to call it, but this representation that can answer risk around desirable, viable, feasible, you know, having that conversation and building that rapport with each leader, you know, design leadership or research leadership, product leadership, engineering leadership. I think that's really important, because if you skew one way or another too far, then you don't know how your risk is in relation to the other themes.
So maybe this is going a little bit too much in the what instead of why. And so feel free to tell me that. But when we think about like the team needing to agree on metrics to use, like you just mentioned a few different roles that people who will be involved in sort of testing the product. And I think, you know, like an engineering manager is probably going to focus on technical metrics and marketing person, maybe on page views, maybe a sales person is going to be most interested in just, you know, revenue generated, right? So do you try to, would you suggest having kind of metrics for those different stakeholder perspectives, or do would you encourage teams to let's focus on a single metric and kind of derive the downstream value from it, say, like, you know, focus on a single number or a collection of numbers when testing an idea?
So I use sort of it's kind of a funny sort of way to call these metrics. We call them pirate metrics because it's A-A-R-R-R-R. That's why we call them pirate metrics. So what I've seen is those three leaders end up owning different pieces of those pirate metrics. So pirate metrics, the way that they're framed from a quantitative point of view, is acquisition, activation, retention. And then depending on your company, it could be referral revenue or revenue referral. So that's mm-hmm. the A-A-R-R-R. There are things, if I went to your company and I went to your brought your engineering leadership, your design leadership, product leadership together. We could say, what does this mean for our product, like our solution? What does it mean for people to be acquired? Oh, well, we're bringing them in from like Meta ads or Google ads or word of mouth or whatever that is. Okay, what does it mean for them to become active? Oh, well, they download our app or they register or there's something that you could probably come up with as a team to say, this is what happens when they become active. Great. What does it mean for them to come back? How often do they come back? Or do we have different subsegments that come back sooner versus, you know, later? And do they use it more frequently versus less frequently? You'll have like these subsegments of customers that use your app in different ways. Okay. From there, it's like, okay, well, what's our referral strategy? What are we tracking there, you know, to get people to refer other customers that would come in through acquisition? What is our revenue? Like, where do we get paid for this? You know, what does that look like? And so what I've noticed is if you have a system like that, and I use that one just because it's one I can remember, and it works pretty well, at least if you have like a SaaS company or B2B or B2C. And that gives you a nice quantitative baseline. And then you could say, you know what? We're measuring this and people just aren't coming back. It's like they come in, we acquire them, they become active, and then they're never seen again. It's like, oh, we could spend all our days working on acquisition, activation, just pump more people in. But if they're just going to churn out just as fast. One team I worked with, the most popular link on their page was, how do I cancel? That is not a great sign. That's because people are not seeing the value in what you've built. So let's focus on retention. Like, let's run some quantitative experiments inside the app. Let's also talk to people and understand why they're churning out, you know? And so I think you need the system in place first. Right? You need to be able to have a baseline. But then you singularity focus. You focus on a specific area that you need to troubleshoot. And I think I made my mistake earlier where I was like, oh, you just march down the path and you build up this whole... No, it's more of, if we get a baseline in place, we can start to see like, where are we losing people? Sometimes it's further upstream. Sometimes they don't even activate. You know, we're driving a bunch of people to a page, they don't even sign up. Well, there's something wrong with our value proposition or our call to action, or like, are we driving the right kind of people to that page? So I think once you have a little system in place, instrumented, and this is the important part, like when you run those experiments, you could see, did we move the needle in a specific way? And that's where this evidence-driven engineering comes from. We had a hypothesis. We think we can increase retention by whatever percent. We ran that experiment. We integrated it. We implemented all the analytics in that, and we ran it, and we saw it made no difference whatsoever, or it made it worse. It's like, okay, let's rethink what we're doing here. And without that, you run a test and then people just look at each other and like, I think the experience is better. Yeah, I do too. And you just move on. Like, you don't know if you actually move the needle. So I do think when we talk about evidence driven, it's, do you have that baseline in place? Do you have agreement across functions about, you know, what these things mean to us? And can we measure them? And then when we test, can we see something move? It does require a bit of discipline. But once you get that baseline in place, you know, at least you're making bets and you're seeing, you know, real results versus just kind of guessing that, you know, okay, I think we made it better. Let's keep doing this.
But it's so much more comfortable just to say, I think we made it better. Like, dealing with real evidence, David, it's hard sometimes. It hurts your ego if that was your idea.
It does. And so there's a lot of mindset stuff here as well, like open to being wrong. And I fall in love with stuff too. I mean, I did this whole thing about the book, about how I tested the book. And the cover I thought was the best cover did not end up being the best cover for the book, in my opinion. And yet the book sold, you know, six figures. So I think it's hard. It's really hard. And we need to be able to work through this mindset shift together of it's okay to be wrong. It's okay to learn and iterate and move forward. And I think it's the one thing that's holding us back right now. It's not the tooling. It's not all the solutions to do this work. It's the, I don't really want to be wrong. So I'm going to run this test for a very long time, or I'm going to put the success criteria so low that I can just hop over that bar and move on. You know, I think there's little ways that we're seeing why people don't want to do this. And it's mostly because they just don't want to be wrong.
Yeah, totally. You made a comment earlier that I want to come back to when someone said, well, you know, a customer wants this. And you said, well, which customer? Right. And so talk a little bit about that, because I think a red flag for me is when the stakeholder is trying to say that they are the customer. Right. They're saying, well, look, I'm a user, too. I want this. Right. And I know what the customer wants. So, you know, it could just be a dodge for what they want as an individual, or, you know, maybe they're always a real user outside of the company, but, you know, it's kind of the single loud customer that they happen to agree with. Right. So how can an engineering leader help sort of mentor that person to work with them on, you know, defining that customer segment, let's say?
Well, there are a couple things there. One is, how far removed are you from your customer? Mm-hmm. So, you know, so I work with really complex businesses, and, you know, we go through this OEM, or we go through this like channel partner, and then we're taking their word for it that they know their customer. And then I have to break it to them that, you know, I actually work with that company too, and they don't know their customers. So that's why they brought me in. Like, be careful of how much, you know, trust you put in their words, because they're trying to figure it out too. So sometimes it makes sense to say, can we go to the end customer and just talk to them or get some evidence? Even if we're never going to sell directly to them, can we go and figure out, you know, is there any evidence whatsoever there? There's also this I'm the customer thing. I worked with a lot of travel companies. It was the worst inside travel companies. I mean, it's like, I travel, I'm the customer. And you're like, no, not really. I mean, how many of you are there in the world, you know? And so I really like that framing of, do they have the problem? Are they aware? Are they actively seeking a solution? I love that framing. I first learned that from like Steve Blank and I think Justin Wilcox and some other folks. But it's stuck. It's one of the things that's worked really well for me when people say, I don't know how to define the segment. I was like, okay, well, who has this problem? Oh, well, these people do. Do they know they have it? Well, this one segment knows they have it, but this other one, I don't think they even know. Like, is there any observable evidence that they know they have a problem? And the way you approach those two different segments is very different. You know, one is, I have to build awareness. I have to talk about symptoms and all this other stuff. And the other one's like, no, they already know they have it. Okay, great. Are they seeking? Is there any observable evidence that they're seeking? Well, some are aware, but they're not seeking. And we have to figure out, okay, why aren't you seeking? Did you try to seek and then just gave up? Or is it not? We call these headache versus migraine problems. Like, they're not seeking because it's kind of just a nuisance and they just ignore it. Versus this other one that says, oh no, it's like a migraine problem for them. They're going to go and seek a solution. So it's a really three-step simple kind of flow. But I find just asking the questions should narrow you down into, okay, we think we have a group of people that they have it, they're aware, and they're trying to find a solution to it because they've either asked us or they're searching online in forums and all these other things. But then it becomes a conversation about investment and how much are we going to invest in this. And I have a hard time with people saying, I'm the customer, I think we should do this. I was like, great. And maybe I'm aging myself out a bit, but like a lot of people I'm working with are near retirement age. It's like, great. Would you bet your retirement on this? Would you, if this was your thing, would you invest your retirement money in it? And they're like, no, I wouldn't do that. It's like, okay, tell me more. Why wouldn't you invest your own? You'll invest the company's money in it, but you wouldn't invest your own money in it. So I try to just get to like their conviction and, you know, is this something that they really would invest in? And that's the other angle of this is like, yeah, you can get your segments probably using the three-step method, but then it becomes would you really invest in this? Like, what kind of evidence would you need to see to invest your retirement in it? So it's like little questions like that, I guess, as a coach I can throw around because I'm coming in from the outside. But they do have an impact because we're trying to figure out, is this something we should invest in? And if people are trying to push it forward, but they would never invest in it themselves, then I start to question the why of why we're trying to push it forward.
David, I think you just changed my life by now I'm going to ask, would I bet my retirement on this idea? And Mariana, you can hold me to that because I'm getting old enough that I need to think that way.
I have to say, I learned that. I have to say, give a shout out to Mike Dabansky. He's somebody I work with and I pair with. And he, I watched him do that. And I was like, ooh, that's really good. So also shout out to Mike. He's amazing. And that, but that is, it gets at some of the heart of what we're trying to do is like the why behind. Yeah. So feel free to steal it. I stole it from Mike and I'm sure he would want everyone else to use it too.
Definitely stolen.
Mariana, what other kind of closing questions do you have for David?
My question is, I've been really good at running short experiments. So say a week, 2 weeks, sprint time. How do you handle longer experiments and when, what are ways that you can say, well, even if we said we would run this experiment for a year, let's pull the plug and mitigate that. You mentioned something about like the length of experiments and sometimes there are things that take a while to like build traction and you know, longer sales cycles, especially in like B2B. So how do you, coordinate that?
It's challenging. And I'm really worried when I see a bunch of long running experiments. It's almost like my feelers go up as a coach of, okay, we're waiting too long to learn, basically, is what's going on here. So there are a couple things that feed into long running experiments to begin with. One is usually we have put too much into the hypothesis we're trying to test. And so I would look for the word and. That's usually the trigger word I look for. So it's like, we believe this and this and this and this and this. And therefore, to get the ultimate proof, we have to run a year-long experiment to find out if we're right. Normally, I would advise against doing that. I would say, okay, let's take all the ands and break those out into separate pieces. And can we test those at smaller in smaller ways? And so that shrinks down your time horizon on your experiments. With the things that are long running B2B sales related, I try to really question the teams and challenge them on what would be the leading indicators that we're headed in the right direction with this. Because you really don't want to be in a situation where we're like, well, we have no idea and we have to wait a year and then we'll find out. We have to find out. Ideally, you want to see leading indicators throughout the year of, okay, we're trending towards that thing happening. Granted, you usually can't predict the future, but you want to break it down into leading indicators of what are the things. I often do this with teams when I talk about this say-do gap. You know, sometimes we have what the customers say and what they do, and we're trying to close that gap. And it's like, okay, well, they said they would do something in an interview. Great directional evidence, but we have no idea if they'll actually do it. And then we're like, oh, we did a survey. People typed in a survey. They would do this. Great directional evidence. But we'd have no idea if they'd actually do what they typed in the survey. What's like the next best test we could run to find out would they do that thing? And it's like, oh, well, we could do some kind of call to action where we invite them in for something and we participate. We do like a co-creation thing. Or we could have them like sign a letter of intent. It's like a one-page non-legally binding document, but they have to put in writing in a different way where it has a little bit more skin in the game, so to speak. And a lot of people won't even do that. You know, one of the famous case studies we have in the book is this guy was trying to sell like this connected sprinkler system thing to landscapers. And they would say like, I want 50 units. And we're like, great, let's put that in writing. And they would say 25. They would write 25. And it's like, you said 50. And they're like, yeah, but let's start with 25. And they realized that like half their demand was gone just by doing letter of intent, just by writing. And they could get out of it. They were non-legally binding. But getting it in writing. Okay, what after that? Well, we could have them prepay a specific amount. We could get it to currency at some point, you know. But I try to think about, like, what's your next best test? What's your currency with your customer? And can you get them to kind of close that gap over time? And there are a lot of things you could do. That's one of the reasons I wrote the book is, you know, there's 44 in there. I have more in that in my, like, AI-powered library now. But this idea of, can we kind of shrink that and find out how, like, get better evidence and stronger evidence and have more confidence as a result? And I think it takes a bit of discipline and a bit of creativity, but it will help you prevent this situation where we have to run an experiment for a year and then find out if we're right or not. Or, you know, we have this, we're going to test this and this and this and this and this. Just like break it down into smaller chunks. And then can we think about that next best test? What was the next thing that we could do that would generate a little better evidence that we're on the right track? I think those two sort of approaches help you stay out of that situation where you have a bunch of long running experiments, because I would be very nervous if I was on a team, I had a bunch of long running experiments and we're waiting to the end of the year to find out, you know, are we right or not?
Absolutely. Well, David, we're pretty much at the end of our time here now. So unfortunately, we need to wrap here and get back to go doing some small experiments and small tests so that I don't have to bet my whole retirement on each of them. But I really appreciate the conversation with you, David. Thanks so much for joining us. Really appreciate it. Are there any closing thoughts that you want to share, or where can our viewers learn more about your work?
Yeah, I live and breathe this stuff. This is what I do every day. I would say if you want to reach out to me, David J. Bland, so it's just my name, davidjbland.com is one way. The company is Precoil, P-R-E-C-O-I-L.com. We have a lot of free resources and things. You could always reach out to me on there. The hot one at the moment is the experiment library, which is all the tests I'm talking about today, but it's packaged in a way where you could have it power like your co-pilot, your internal co-pilot, and suggest experiments for you. So that's a really hot one right now. And then I'm always active on LinkedIn. Just search my name. You're probably see a bunch of memes and all kinds of posts from me. But I have a good time on LinkedIn, which I never thought I would say. I kind of treat it like I used to treat Twitter in a way back in the day. And I just try to make people laugh and educate them and share. You know, I try to be really transparent and build in public of what I'm working on. I try to really apply it to what I'm doing. So davidjbland.com, precoil.com, or just find me on LinkedIn. I'm pretty easy to spot.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Really appreciate you joining us today, David.
Thanks for having me.
And Mariana, thanks for co-hosting with me today as well.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure talking to David. I'm a huge fan.
And for all of you who want to learn more about this episode or any other episode of the Scaling Tech Podcast, make sure to check us out at scalingtechpod.com. Thanks for listening to the Scaling Tech Podcast. In addition to bringing the Scaling Tech Podcast to you, at Agility Feet, we help companies to build tech teams across Latin America that are truly theirs. We can help you scale with confidence, with everything from staff augmentation to establishing your own technical center of excellence through our Build, Operate, Transfer model. We can do that for you in Colombia, Panama, Mexico, or elsewhere in Latin America. So check us out at agilityfeet.com to learn more. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to the Scaling Tech Podcast on YouTube, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're enjoying this episode. We'll continue to bring you insightful conversations about engineering leadership and building technical teams. To see our past episodes, check out scalingtechpod.com.